Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the Bookshop Podcast. Each week, I present interviews with independent bookshop owners from around the globe, authors, and specialists in subjects dear to my heart, the environment and social justice. To help the show reach more people, please share it with friends and family and on social media. And remember to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to this podcast. And if you'd like to donate to the show, head on over to thebookshoppodcast.buzzsprout.com. Click on the orange heart in the right-hand corner of the page where you can donate via Buy Me a Coffee. And thanks to everyone who has supported the show. You're listening to episode 170. David Rocklin grew up in Chicago and graduated from Indiana University with a BA in literature. After attending law school, he pursued a career as an in-house attorney and continues to serve as a mediator. David is the author of The Night Language and The Luminist and lives in California with his wife and children. Hi, David, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
My pleasure. It's lovely to have you here. Let's talk a little bit about you and your background before we move on to your books. You have a career as an in-house attorney and mediator. What led you to write novels?
It's funny. I came to it from a slightly different direction in that I feel, although that I almost chose law because of the writing involved. I've been writing in one shape, form, or another since I was a kid. In fact, I really do believe that it has always been how I understand life and sort of take the world in. I sometimes feel as though the world doesn't make a lot of sense to me until I start writing somehow about it, and then it begins to clarify. So I think that the idea of law school and law, to me, was just writing in another guise. It's using language as in a different form of communication. So that's kind of what drew me to it. And honestly, for better or for worse, I've always viewed that career as kind of the necessary mechanism so that I could write whatever I wanted without having to worry about writing being the only source of support that I have. Otherwise, somebody can tell you what you have to write if you want to be paid. So this was a way for me to insulate my artistic choices, be able to do what I want because my bills are paid. The worst thing you can do to me is say, I don't want to publish that, in which case, okay, my family and I will still be fine. I'll just move on to something else and deal with ego bruising, but that's the worst that it gets. So that's not bad.
And David, I don't know about you, but I don't know of too many authors who aren't working a main job or a part-time job to support their writing.
Yeah.
I would say most authors I know have had to put some money aside for marketing, whether they're traditionally published with a small medium press or definitely when you're self-published. And marketing is expensive. It's extremely difficult to make a living as a full-time writer.
Yeah, that's true.
And speaking of which, I would love it if you could share your journey from your first finished manuscript to finding a literary agent and publishing deal.
So I think that as your listeners know, there are many routes to getting an agent, right? None of them are easy. They're all extraordinarily challenging and full of hurdles and obstacles. And the one thing that I think is even harder than rejection, which is the quiet, that you know, as you sit and wait and wonder, what do they think? Are they going to say something? Does this quiet mean they haven't gotten to it? Does the quiet mean they did and this is just a silent pass? I don't know what this means. It's all very nerve-wracking and you really have to have a thick skin and a good sense of self just to embark on that part of the writing journey. But I've now had two agents, both of whom I came to in different ways. My first agent I came to because they were the relation of someone I knew. And so I got to a conversation with them, had told them about something I was working on. She asked if she could take a look at it and decided to represent me. That one was absolutely not ready to be seen by the publishing industry. But despite that, it went out. And it met with the obligatory, yeah, I don't think so. But it was such an important part of my writing journey just to be able to deal with the rejection, but also to hear what was wrong with it and begin to learn a little bit more about the craft of writing. And, you know, this is how we get to a place of creation of something publishable. by whatever avenue people follow, is you write and you fail and you write and you fail and you write and you fail, and then you keep going and you don't stop. So in that one, you know, it was by virtue of just a relationship. The second one, one of my dearest friends and a writing mentor recommended me to an agent who represented her. And so I turned in the novel that would become The Luminist to that agent, and they took it up very quickly. I've actually left that agency for what is now my third novel. They were wonderful to me. They've made my publishing dream come true. Everybody has their own publishing dream. Mine has always been traditional publishing. I'm not going to be somebody who self-publishes. It doesn't scratch the itch that I have when it comes to writing. So I will now be, once I've finished the revision of this new one, embarking on a search for an agent, and that will probably be by way of introductions and referrals from writers I know. But it may also enter into the querying process, which I have lots of thoughts on, and give guidance to other writers on writing a good query letter, where my legal background does come into play in terms of being able to write something that's tight, that's organized. But when I think about the journey to an agent, you know, with a manuscript in hand, I feel like I have gone every route there is to find an agent. The only thing I haven't done, I would say, is writing conferences where you pitch. I haven't done that, and that's just because I haven't gotten to it. I wouldn't look askance at it. It's just not one that has come up on my list of things that I've gotten to.
And did you have the same agent for The Night Language?
Yes, the same agent represented The Luminist and The Night Language.
Both wonderful books, and we'll definitely talk about The Luminist shortly. Now, I would love to hear about Rorschach, which is something that you host. It's a monthly reading series in Echo Park. How did you become involved with this group, and where was the group founded? And also, I guess you've only just come back in person, right, after being virtual for a couple of years.
Yes, we went virtual for the entirety. Well, I personally believe the pandemic remains with us.
Yes, agreed.
But for, I would say, the entirety of the height of the first wave. So I think we're all now looking at historical moments. My wife and I occasionally will look at each other and say, do you remember those halcyon days of the early pandemic when we thought that a couple weeks worth of tuna is all we needed, and here we are 2 years later, sheltering in place and masking aggressively? It's really just, if we stop and think about what we've went through, it's just remarkable.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I find it hard to even remember what life was like pre-pandemic.
Yeah, but yeah, our last live show was February 2020, before we went on a virtual version of the show up until June of this year. So it was just over 2 years of nothing but virtual shows. And thankfully, the community that has built up around Rorschach remained with us, came to all the virtual shows. And interestingly, I was able to access writers from outside California who could pop in from all over the world, which they did, and audiences could. I've gone back to live shows. I'm considering whether to do some sort of a hybrid, because that broadened audience was really lovely. So I've got that in my back pocket. We'll see if I do that. I'm really enjoying seeing people in person right now. But the way the show started, the series, honestly, and this is a little bit of a dated reference, but this was a little bit of a Mickey and Judy let's put on a show moment for me, and it came after the book tour ended for The Luminist. I didn't come up in an MFA program. I was a writer who learned by reading and learned by doing, and didn't really have access even to workshops due to a variety of circumstances. And so when the first novel was picked up by an agent and then published, and then there was a book tour, that was honestly the first true time, I think, that I'd been in the company of writers, at conferences, at festivals, at readings where there were multiple writers on the bill, in addition to writers who would come and see me and I would go see them. And it was really kind of my introduction to sort of that immersive world. And when I came off of that tour, I really missed it. you know, as writers, we know, you know, we have a lot of people in our life who don't write. And if you sit down and try to tell them, I tackled part of my revision today, they'll be like, that's nice. And that they're not going to, you know, they don't feel it on like a genetic level. But if you tell another writer, I tackled that part of the revision today, they're going to be like, very much get it. I feel you hard right now. And I really miss that sort of secondhand understanding, that depthful empathy that you get from other people who do what you do. So I really wanted to figure out, okay, well, how am I going to remain in the company of writers? I'm just going to miss this if I don't go back to it. And so I actually accessed a couple of writers who I'd met while I was out and about. And they said, well, you're in LA. LA's got a really cool lit community. Why don't you just reach out to some of those folks and maybe put together a series and do some readings with them? I'm like, great. Who are they? So I got like a few names. And out of complete naivete, I reached out to them and said, hey, you guys, why don't you come to dinner on such and such a date? I'm buying. I want to put together a reading series. And so, like, you know, 11 of them showed up probably for the free food. I'm still friends with a good number of them. And they all were like, yeah, put together a reading series. There's always room for one more. Why not? You know, one of them who, when I see her, I always remind her of this, walked me out to the parking lot and said, yeah, this is going to crash and burn. Just don't even bother. But that's where it started. And so it began about 10 years ago. And it began as a monthly series, and it has just kind of rolled forward. We have our next iteration of it this coming Sunday, and it's been lovely. I have met and made some dear and very cherished friends. I've encountered some extraordinary writing. I've been very fortunate to be told by a few folks that pieces that they began at a portion of our show called Live Write, which is kind of a fun little writing contest, turned into pieces that they published. So it's really just been lovely, and I'm just going to keep it going for as long as people seem to like it.
Well, I think what you're doing is fabulous. And I looked at some of the ways you get writers writing at the workshops and some of the prompts. And I'm always amazed when I work on a prompt or I go to a writing workshop, get a prompt, I work it out, write it out, I should say. And a few months later, I'll remember that prompt and I'm able to work it into the piece I'm working on. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yes, it is fun. Now, because you and I have both lived and worked in Los Angeles within the creative community, mine being in the film industry, working as a costume designer and attending and presenting writing workshops, I love the creativity in Los Angeles. So let's talk about that. What do you enjoy most about the Los Angeles Creative Network, in particular, the writing community? Let's share with the rest of the world what an amazing creative community we have here in Los Angeles.
It is so great. And to me, the strength of it is just, and this is in any way you want to interpret the word, the diversity. It's diversity of thought. It's diversity of voice. It's diversity of discipline, diversity of form, diversity of experience that goes into what's being created. It's everything. I mean, there are pockets that are doing spoken word visual hybrids. There are people who are performing balancing acts with how brave their memoirs are. There is just writing across every spectrum you can think of. And from what I've seen, and I've now been fortunate enough to sort of dip into literary communities kind of around the country when I'm out there touring with a book or something, I've never seen anything but support amongst writers in the LA lit community. People show up for each other. They don't view the success of one as somehow detracting from their experience or, you know, oh, I can't believe they sold that book. Ugh. So annoying. I just don't see it, you know. We all hope that, you know, good things happen for the stuff that we write, but people are cheering each other on. I just don't see the backbiting. I don't see jealousy. I don't see envy. I just see a lot of support, a lot of love. and a lot of like, you know, high fives in person and on social media when someone does something and they just say, hey, I wrote this thing and it's meaningful to me that these words get to go out into the world. People receive it. And I see that, you know, in kind of a microcosm at the reading series, where, you know, it's hard, you know, having gone through different modes of expression, whether it's putting a design that you created out there and hearing people make comments or the writing that you do, when you put something out there, you're wondering how it's going to be received. Will it be understood? Will it be criticized? If it's something that's close to you, is that criticism going to feel like personal rejection? It's an act of bravery. And the people that I, maybe I'm just lucky, but the people who I socialize with and who I see at the reading series and at readings, they understand that the words that are being given to them were probably very hard to come by. And they receive it as the gift and the token of trust and faith in them that those words are. And the reader who comes up there and does it, you know, you can see their face. They're like, oh my God, my words kind of matter. My voice kind of matters. It's a beautiful moment to be a part of.
Yeah, there's so much talent in Los Angeles, creative talent. It's amazing.
Yeah. You know, we get such a bad rap. People say, oh, LA, that's where everybody goes because they've got a script in their back pocket or they want to act. And I hear that criticism and I think, so what you're saying is you're making fun of it because everybody goes there because they don't want to just simply dream passively anymore. They want to go see if they can make it happen. And there you are, not doing that, but criticizing them. So no, that takes guts.
Yes, it does. I remember when I landed in Los Angeles, I think it was 82 or 83. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, it's so big. The city is enormous. I couldn't believe how long the streets were, like Santa Monica Boulevard or Venice or Olympic. It was just ridiculous. It was overwhelming. And it's not easy trying to find somewhere to live and get set up and navigate around the city.
That is true. I was a Chicago kid and I came to LA and I'm like, this is not a city the way I understand a city. Where am I right now? It took me a while.
Yeah, it's a process, isn't it? Now, let's talk about The Luminist. It was published by Hawthorne Books and Literary Arts in 2011, and it's set in colonial India at a time of growing friction between the ruling British and the restless Indian populace. A Victorian woman and her young Tamil Indian servant defy convention, class, and heartbreak to investigate what is gained and lost by holding life still through the art of photography. The story is similar to the life and work of photographic pioneer Julia Margaret Cameron. When did your interest in Cameron first come to light?
Yeah, I can pinpoint it to the precise day. And it's just, I think it speaks to the strange and myriad ways that stories find us. You just never know what's going to stick with you. One day, my wife and I went to the Getty Museum in LA, which is, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It is such a cool place. The building itself is architecturally a museum exhibit. It's gorgeous, you know, and the grounds and the gardens, and it's amazing. And they had a photographic installation of early age photography from kind of the dawn of the technology. And among the installation were photos by Ms. Cameron. And I had never heard of her, but there was something about the photos that were really captivating. I'm always drawn to older things. Every book I write seems to be historically set. And I'm sure that there's thematic elements that just draw me every single time. I'm a sucker for that. But there was something also about her photographs, particularly those photographs where she was portraying her subject kind of in and out of shadow. And when I began to learn a little bit more about her, I remember reading a biography because I was just curious. You know, I was facing these photos that were taken at a time when the woman who created them had to go through every wall that was put up against women at this time. Social conventions, political conventions, you know, a woman having a vocation or an avocation outside the home. This was not just frowned upon, it was forbidden. So I'm like, who is this transgressive badass who did these amazing images? I need to just learn a little bit about her. And at the time, I wasn't thinking book. I was thinking, she's just interesting to me. And so I read a biography of hers, and there was a line that just jumped out at me and became the basis of this novel. And the line was that, like many women at the time, she lost a child at birth. And so that was sort of the little drop of the last chemical that just made the beaker overflow. And for days, I was sitting there with the thought of her, the images she created, and that fact. And what began to form was this idea of a woman who, the only way she could hang on to memory of those she loved and lost was memory, which was a frail, fragile thing that always tatters away with time. And so what kind of came to the surface was the notion of a woman who basically has sworn, I will never lose someone again to memory. I'm going to find a way to hold the people I love still forever. And so that kind of almost obsession led me into the novel, and became, you know, once I learned that she had spent a brief period of her life in what is now Sri Lanka in Ceylon, India, that's where the story began to really take shape.
Well, David, it's a beautiful story.
Thank you.
And it was one that led me down a lot of rabbit holes because I ended up really exploring Julia Margaret Cameron's work and her life. Let's talk about your second book, The Night Language, published by Rare Bird Books in 2017. It won the Bronze Medal for the Forward Indies Award for LGBT Fiction. And it tells the story of a young man, Prince Alamayu of Abyssinia, and his lover, Philip Laird, and the consequences of repressive societies. What drew you to this story?
So speaking of going deep down rabbit holes with Julia Margaret Cameron, what ended up happening after The Luminous sold, and while I was trying to think about what to write next, something had been hanging with me. And it came from the research I did for The Luminous. I was very fortunate as I was researching that first novel. It's not really my first novel. I have the obligatory writer's drawer full of crap that will never see the light of day because it's like astonishingly bad, but at the time it made sense. But when I was researching that, the Getty Museum was kind enough to let me look in their archives at all of her photos. And so, I mean, it was amazing to see the breadth of what she did. It's so cool. But there was one photo that would not leave me alone. And it was a photo of a boy of about 10, I would say, a young black boy dressed in what colonial English in the mid to late 19th century would have thought like a quote-unquote African should look like. You can see on his face, he is bereft, he is lonely, he is terrified, and he is really angry. And it's just this fascinating, and I'm like, who is this kid? You know, out of the pictures that she took, who is this child? But I kind of set it aside because I had a book to write. And then once it found its home, I found myself going back to the image. So I began doing some research and learned that in real life, he was Alamayu, the son of Tewodros, the emperor of Ethiopia. Tewodros was essentially kind of a Christian zealot who fancied himself as carrying out a modern crusade against the Islamic countries around him. Abyssinia, of course, is now Ethiopia. So he had written to Queen Victoria, and he had said, I must continue the fight for Christianity. Please send me weapons. And Queen Victoria, you know, being no slouch when it came to governing, basically sent a small contingent of you know, representatives of her government to say, no, we're not going to arm you and, you know, begin a war, a proxy war through you. So he held those folks captive. And in response, Parliament voted to invade. And it was over in about 2 days. And this all happened in real life. Tewodros was basically killed himself rather than be taken. And they took his son, Alamayu. And so if you can imagine this sort of colonialist invasion force taking, they're the ones who caused Alamayu's family to essentially end. They took him and they brought him across the ocean to England, and he became a ward of Queen Victoria's court. So the first iteration of that story, the character of Philip, who had a different name, was more of a father figure. based upon an actual British officer who became kind of a father figure to this young boy. Over the course of several drafts, Alemayehu became older, and Philip took on the persona of somebody who was in the first draft, just a mention, which was on the ship bound back for England after the war is over. There's only one other black face on the entire ship, and it was somebody who was apprenticed to one of the surgeons on the ship, but all they did was see each other. Out of nowhere, over a course of drafts, that person became the love of his life. And I can remember vividly, it happened at a moment in a subsequent draft where they happened to find themselves standing at the ship rail next to each other with their hands next to each other. And they were both looking at their hands and realizing there's nobody else here who looks like this. And that moment led to a very unexpected love story. It was not my intention to write a love story when this book began, but that is what it became. And frankly, I think that's what sold it.
Well, it's a beautifully written story.
Thank you.
You bring up an important point, and that is the art of observing, which for me is what being a creative person is all about, specifically being a writer or a painter. I don't know how many of those little moleskin books I carry around in my purse, because I'm always thinking of notes or names that I need to write down for future reference. And as for my camera phone, I think it has about 22,000 photos on it right now. I think it's important to be aware of everything around you so that you're like a sponge and you just take it all in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, in addition to the novel writing and everything else, I've written and will shortly be completing a craft book called The Right Formula, which kind of takes you through the writing process kind of from idea generation through the end. And that's something that we'll talk about not only in the book, but also in like a physical writing retreat that I'll be creating up in Idlewild, which is such a fun, lovely place. But the idea that there are just story ideas all around you, and one of them is literally trying to find a place to land. So just be open. You never know. You absolutely never know.
And apart from a good, solid story, what traits does one need to go from a gatherer of stories to a writer and published author?
The easy one, I know that everybody probably recognizes, you have to have a bit of a thick skin. Criticism, rejection is absolutely a part of this work, and it is work. And that word, work, is kind of what I think about in terms of what you need more than anything. You need talent. You need a penchant for storytelling. You need a certain joy in the telling of a story. I mean, that process of telling a story has to be something that's precious and vital to you. If you're just trying to approach telling a story in a workmanlike way, like making dinner when you're tired, you're not going to make it very far, nor should you. Why do that to yourself? But I think the trait that's more important than anything is relentlessness. You cannot stop. It will get hard. There will be moments where you just don't know what to say. There will be moments where you put your everything into a story and someone says, yeah, you know, I'm not really feeling it. All of that stuff's going to happen. And it's going to happen at every level. It's going to happen to, you know, your first story. It's going to happen to your 100th story after you've been published 10 times. Someone's going to say, yeah, you know, I loved your old books, but I'm not really feeling this one. I'm sorry. The market has turned. You know, we want, you know, bionic unicorns. That's what we're looking for. And that's not what this is. You have to persevere and you have to be able to stay true to what it is that made you say it is worth years of my life and blood and sweat to make this story come out of me. You got to remember why you felt that way, because it's easy to kind of lose that as people start telling you, you know, the joke I always have is, oh, I love this beautiful story of two young black men who fall in love, but make it a musical. You know, it's like in the name of making something marketable, you're going to get a lot of feedback. You have to be relentless, not only in the work and in persevering through criticism, rejection, but you have to be relentless as you hold on to the core of the story that made you want to write it in the first place. Don't let go of that.
Yes, I agree with you. And something I've learned, and maybe it's just personal to me, is by about your third or fourth book, you start to get it. You start to understand how writing works, how writing a story evolves, and what works best for you. And sometimes that door that we're waiting for to open, sometimes it can take years, but we just have to be ready for it or push it open.
Yeah. Especially when we were starting out, we are all in a hurry. We all have that penchant. And this is honestly, and you know, I don't mean to offend anyone who may listen to this, but this is one of the things that does sometimes give me a little bit of a fright and a little bit of a pause when it comes to self-publishing. Because when it comes to writers, we all have that part of us that say, well, this just poured raw out of my heart. It's ready. You know, and it's always too soon, and it always needs more work, and the revision is always where the story truly comes out. But there, you know, we are all susceptible to someone, including ourselves, especially saying, this is fine as it is. Great, put it out there.
And David, this is something I have experience with because I've published 4 books, and it's taken me to 3 books to find editors that I trust. And for my next manuscripts, I'd like to try to find an agent and hopefully a publishing deal. To self-publish successfully, you need to have quite a bit of money behind you because you need to pay your team, your, you know, a couple of different editors, your formatting team, cover designer, marketing team. There are so many costs involved that people tend to kind of wash over that because they think, oh no, it's free to self-publish. It is if you're not prepared to go the professional route. And this is what causes a lot of harm to self-publishing. That's my view.
That's the thing that people, I think, when they look at self-publishing and they think about those instances where a self-published title blew up, they don't stop and think about how much went into that. Not just money, but just the sheer investment of time to market, to rise that book's title above the fray of 1,000 books a week that come out. It's an extraordinary personal investment of resources that you can measure in dollars, and resources you cannot measure in terms of just energy and time and your life. And it, you know, I think that I have friends who have self-published, and I always just I never pretend to tell them, oh, that's a lesser form. But it's more like, just please be eyes open about this. Please know what you're getting into before you get into it.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. Good advice. Let's talk about books. What are you currently reading? And is there a book or books that you'd like to see more people reading?
So I'm going to take this time because there's always books that I'm reading. Although at this moment, while I'm working very intently on revision, I tend not to read because it's too much of a convergence of voices in my head. But I really just want to be able to shout out and illuminate some books that are out right now by writers who I am fortunate to call friends because they're so beautifully done. So in terms of poetry, there's a book called To Revere Place by a dear friend of mine, Arani Weejasinghe. Gorgeous poetry collection. The Flannery O'Connor Award winner, her next story collection, which is called Light Skin Gone to Waste, is coming out with Roxane Gay's imprint. And her name is Toni Ann Johnson, and she has this novella called Homegoing, which is so striking and so stunning. Cannot recommend it enough. She's an extraordinary writer. And if you ever get a chance to see her read live, there's no one better. And a gorgeous memoir by another writer friend named Cassandra Lane called We Are Bridges, which was getting a lot of notice, a lot of positive attention because it's just extremely powerful in terms of just voice and generational connection. It's absolutely beautiful. So you can't go wrong with any of those. And a novel that I just love because it's so much fun by a friend of mine, Bruce Ferber, is called I Buried Paul, which is the best novel you're ever going to read about a Beatles tribute band. It's so much fun. He was a producer and writer for sitcoms some time back, and that breeziness and that sense of fun and sense of play is present in the book. Highly recommend it.
Well, thank you for that. That's a great list of books, and I will make sure to put all of the links in the show notes. Now, you said earlier you're working on your final revision for your next book. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah. Never say never. But I'm one of those where if I could pick up the Luminist right now, I'd probably red pen it to death. it never ends for me. Yeah, it never ends. It never ends.
Oh, I hear you, David. I understand that only too well. David, it's been great chatting with you. Thanks for all you do to help other writers through Rorschach. And I wish you all the best with your upcoming novel.
You too. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.
You've been listening to my conversation with David Rocklin, author of The Night Language and The Luminist. Make sure to follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Mandy Jackson Beverly. And check out my website at mandyjacksonbeverly.com. And if you'd like to contribute to the Coffee Fund, go to thebookshoppodcast.brassprout.com, click on the little orange heart in the right-hand corner of the page, and you can donate through Buy Me a Coffee. For information regarding sponsoring an episode, email thebookshoppodcast@gmail.com. The Bookshop Podcast is written and produced by Mandy Jackson Beverly. Theme music provided by Brian Beverly, executive assistant to Mandy, Adrian Otterhan, and graphic design by Francis Farala. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.